Hey friends, welcome to the Rhythms for Life podcast, where each week we talk about four rhythms that help you reduce stress and anxiety and take charge of your emotional health. Rest, restore, connect, create. Today's episode is brought to you by Bethany House Publishers and Sissy Goff's book, Raising Worry-Free Girls. In her newest book, veteran counselor Sissy offers practical advice on how you can instill bravery and strength in your daughter, helping her understand why her brain is often working against her when she starts to worry and what she can do to fight back. Purchase your copy of Raising Worry-Free Girls at your favorite book retailer. So excited about today with Sissy Goff. She's amazing.
I know. It's going to be great for all of us to just hear her wisdom, because so many times this anxiety conversation, we realize it's getting younger and younger. Anybody out there listening that has kids, it's probably not uncommon that you've heard them at some point go, I feel anxious. I mean, this is going all the way down to five-year-olds.
Right. We talk about this with Sissy, where it begins, and often how we as parents actually can perpetuate this, which is really convicting for me as a mom, because I'm thinking, how am I projecting some of my anxiety onto my kids? And being aware of that when it happens. She really goes into the science behind this, practical tips. It's very, very approachable. I love the way she doesn't make you feel ostracized because you might have some anxious thoughts and what kids with anxiety might need. We found this in our own home to be very, very helpful with our girls.
Yeah, I think our boys, I mean, right? It's like, this is happening for everybody. And while she wrote this awesome book called Raising Worry-Free Girls, the whole content of this applies to anybody who's a parent. And even if your children are really young, this is going to be relevant. If your children are in college, this is going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. Because what I love about her approach is it really helps simplify what's happening in the brain. And then how do we redirect? How do we take some of this latent energy that's starting to go towards anxiety and start to shape and shift it towards something that builds confidence?
I know for us, when Kennedy was in middle school and she started to feel some anxiety in ways that I was feeling kind of in midlife, she had her puppies. They were her buddies, like her besties. In fact, this hits home for us because this week we lost one of our puppies. It was time. We had to put our puppy Trevi down, and it was heartbreaking because we really reflected as a family this week how much Trevi was a part of her healing, honestly, even in a place where she could take some of her anxiety. And part of it, I think, is because kids don't always have language for what they're feeling. They feel these big feelings and they want to be seen, heard, and known. And sometimes they can't give that to each other in friendships because they're still all going through puberty. They're all a little confused of what's going on. And then you come home and you've got family and a lot of energy and pace and a lot of going on. And yet you've got these sweet little dogs who are like, hey, I'll just hang out with you. I'll hang out with you and I'll be near. And I just think that's really sweet, the role that even pets can play with kids that have anxiety.
Yeah, I think obviously animals, people are bringing animals on airplanes. I mean, we understand the role that they play in being a calming force in people's lives. My heart broke when Kennedy was describing how Trevi would lick her tears. You know, that was just like,
wow. I
know. Heartbreaking when she would be alone in a room and really sad about something that he was licking her tail. I'm like, okay, I can understand why this dog has meant a lot to you, because mm-hmm. I think for his life, 10 years, you know, for both of our kids, it was the one consistent thing in their life when we moved from Atlanta to New York City and then to Nashville. Mm-hmm. It was the only thing that remained the same. We moved schools, homes. We added a child into our home now. And so anyway, the dog has been there. And I think as Sissy gets into this, I think you're going to all start to see, like, we all deal with anxious feelings probably. We have new language for how we're talking about it now. But when we dig in a little deeper, we'll realize that even behind that word anxious, there's probably something else more going on that just all of us, the more equipped we are to talk about it, the more healthier the environments we're trying to lead will be. So let's listen in now to Sissy Goff.
Sissy, welcome. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with y'all.
I remember I first heard your name from a mutual friend a few years back, because I'm raising daughters. Yes. And of course, I have a little history of my own anxiety. And it's just been fun to get to know you in the last few months and even just hear what you speak about through our school, as well as what you write about. You've just released a couple books this past fall, and you have a wealth of experience. Just share a little bit of your backstory, what you do, how you got to this point.
So I have been counseling girls and families for 27 years now, which makes me feel so old.
you started when you were five.
Exactly, yes, at a really cool place called Daystar Counseling Ministries that is a little yellow house in the middle of Nashville where we
adorable.
Have, it's pretty cute, and we have 14 counselors, I think, at last count, 1,700 families that are coming to Daystar, and 5 dogs on staff, which are many of our kids' favorite therapists.
1,700 families?
1,700 families.
In that little house?
Isn't that crazy?
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time, no.
It is amazing, though, to be there and just see, you know, what's happening.
It's so much energy. Like, kids are just all at the tables, and they're doing interactives, and they're playing. It's like this, like their after-school favorite thing.
I know. They love it. That's what's so sweet about it. One little boy called it the little yellow house that gives hope, which I thought is such a great picture.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, there's a stigma around children having counseling, right?
Right.
And I know we got over that years ago with our kids to try to give them space to process what they're feeling. But speak to how helpful you have seen this role of children having a place to talk to somebody that's not just their parents, but somebody who's trained to help them process all the things that they're feeling.
Oh, I think it's just invaluable because for little ones, they so often, whatever's going on, whether it's anxiety or depression or their parents are getting divorced or they've lost someone, they feel like they're the only one in the universe that's ever experienced that. Mm-hmm. And so to have a place that feels warm and engaging and it's people they feel comfortable with and can trust, and they're not worried about talking about it might upset my mom or dad more, so I can talk to someone I don't know, that's so helpful. And then for adolescents, we laugh a lot at Daystar and say, we're really saying the same thing parents are saying to kids. We're just a new voice.
Right.
And so sometimes they hear us a little louder. And I think everybody needs other voices on their team.
And there's no baggage attached to your voice.
Yes.
You're an objective person. And you were telling us that the onset of anxiety is lower now than ever.
Lower now than ever. It was 8. It has now dropped to 6.
And age 6.
Age 6. And you can start to see symptoms as young as 4 and 5.
So that's kindergarten for
yes.
so many of us.
Right.
Or not us. I'm not in kindergarten. But I have a kindergartner right
for
now.
For so many parents of kindergartners. Right. Yes.
All right. Well, we got to get into this because the idea of anxiety 30 years ago was not a conversation anybody was having.
No.
So now to say all these little kids are feeling anxiety, I need you to help me understand, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
You know, is this just new language we're giving to something that's always existed, or are there new dynamics in our lives today that is creating this onset?
Both. I mean, I think there were probably anxious kids when we were growing up that we sat next to them in school and we didn't really realize what was going on. I mean, I think we were anxious. You know, I joke with a lot of parents who are type A and say, I think all of us who are type A or ones on the Enneagram have some degree of anxiety. We just didn't know that's what it was.
Sure.
We weren't talking about it when we were growing up. And so, I mean, I think both things. Statistically now, it's 1 in 4 kids have anxiety and girls are twice as likely. So,
wow. Is that the same for adults as far as women being more likely?
Yes, absolutely. And we weren't talking about it back then, but I also don't think it was as prevalent. And there are a lot of factors going into that. Some is, you know, we can talk so much about technology in kids and how social media for sure for adolescents is creating more anxiety in kids. But younger than that, I talked to a psychiatrist. We were working together with a teenager not long ago, and she said, you know, it's not even just social media. It's that when we are looking at a device, the degree of images and videos and stimulation that's bombarding our brains, it just makes us anxious. And when their brains aren't finished developing, they can't calm themselves back down yet, like we can, hopefully.
Would you give a distinctive, I've had other people do this, but it's always said a little bit uniquely. Give a distinctive for what you see in girls coming through between anxiety versus depression?
So, well, it's confusing because there are so many things that bleed into each other.
Yeah, you can have both.
Right. And ADHD. I mean, as we're talking about anxiety, for younger kids, especially anxiety and ADHD symptomatically look almost identical. So to be able to tell the difference, and in both cases, they struggle in school a lot and with depression often too. And so what happens is they can't focus. And with a child who has anxiety, it's more of a sense of, I always say with kids, it's like the one loop roller coaster at the fair. And there's just something they get stuck in their little brain and it just cycles over and over and over. And when I say that to kids in my counseling office, they look like, oh, no one's ever known what was happening inside of me before. You know, that just rings true for them. Whereas with the depression, I think there's more of a pervasive sadness rather than worry.
Okay. So when you talk about the loop at the fair, that feels a little to me like OCD as far as like repeating, needing that reassurance over and over and over.
Yes.
We have a child that just asks for a lot of things repeatedly, like Cade. I'll just say it. Cade, he has limited verbal. Right. And I've never thought of it from the lens of anxiety, but if there's something he wants, he's going to say that thing possibly 100 times within the course, if we don't reassure him over and over and over again that he will indeed get a cup of Coke next Wednesday.
I know. It's amazing the kinds of questions.
I didn't know that was the things that he loops
on. One of the things I learned from you is to make it a 5-question limit.
Yes.
Don't let those children just go on and satisfy that, because it's not going to end.
Right.
And you describe these two different types of reactions where we see anxiety happening. You call them exploders and imploders. Can you just talk about, to the parents who are listening, who are trying to self-diagnose or diagnose at least in their own family, what's happening with their children? What's that difference between an exploder and an imploder?
That's a great question, because I think we were talking earlier about how often we don't know that it's anxiety. And so it will be a child who, when you say, I need you to go brush your teeth right now, and they just lose it, that would be an exploder, that there's a lot of emotion, often a lot of anger. It manifests as anger with all ages, but especially younger ones. And so when it's around a transition, when it's around bedtime, often it'll come out then, but an exploder is going to have a lot of emotion that you really see manifest, whereas an imploder is often more perfectionistic, and so they don't feel like they can let themselves get angry or even express much disappointment. And so it stays internal for them a lot of times, and they end up, I mean, sometimes they'll end up exploding, but it takes a whole lot longer for them to get there.
So how do you suggest brushing teeth without it being World War III? Because I do think some parents are like, why is this eliciting so much anger? Or what you even said earlier to me, it could feel like manipulation.
Right.
So how, if you have an exploder, I would imagine there's probably a version of each type of person in every family, right?
Yes, that's a great point.
Because we all complement each other so well. Even a spouse, usually there's one that's more anxious, right?
Right, yes.
So knowing that, how do you, I'll go back to that in a second, but for the exploder versus imploder, as a parent, you still need some structure. They need to brush their teeth. What do you do with someone who just explodes? Is it because they weren't expecting it? What is that?
Often it's because they weren't expecting it, and you changed the schedule on a dime, and they didn't think that was what was going to happen. And so with kids who explode and it's over transitions, it's great to give them lead time whenever we can. Tell them what's happening. As much as we can have visual cues up so they know what's coming, that's really helpful. And I'm going to contradict myself a lot, that whole both and thing as we get older that we realize. But they also really need to learn flexibility.
Okay.
Because flexibility is one of the biggest antidotes to anxiety.
Oh, wow.
Any of us who are anxious don't have a lot of flexibility, myself included. And so we want to be giving them some structure and lead time, but when we can add some flexibility in, it's really important. But an exploder who's anxious is not the child that you pick them up from school and say, hey, we're going to Disney World. But they don't need that kind of flexibility. They may very likely melt down about that.
I love it.
And you talked a little bit about parents and adults also have an anxiety, but what role are parents playing in creating atmospheres where anxiety flourishes? And what is it that parents can do to create kind of a better environment? You've just given us a couple practical things of scheduling, giving them a little bit of lead time, but talk specifically about parents and their own anxiety and how that's playing a role in that environment.
So if you're a parent with anxiety, your child is 7 times more likely to have it themselves. And I would say, wow. I mean, I really feel like pretty much every time I sit in counseling with an anxious child, they have one parent who's anxious. So I think there's a huge genetic component. And sometimes, and really even to get you off the hook and not make you feel guilty, sometimes it's just purely genetic. It's not that you're doing something to make it worse.
But you might be.
Right. One of the things I read, we were joking about how I read 23 books to write this book. And one of the things that I read talked about how anxious parents even use more catastrophic language. Like, that's terrible or that's horrible. And our reactions are so significant that then they end up modeling that, or they're alerted to something they wouldn't have even felt like was wrong to begin with. So, I mean, that's just a really simple, practical thing. But the other thing I would say that's really, well, two other things. One is that all children long to be independent. Mm-hmm. And so when we're hovering, we're keeping them often from learning to do that. And I came up with this definition of anxiety throughout the research, that anxiety is an overestimation of the problem and an underestimation of themselves.
Wow.
And so when we're stepping in and rescuing over and over and over, we're reinforcing, yes, the problem's bigger and you're smaller. You wow. can't do it.
That's good.
And this is the tension. I mean, as a parent, it seems like it's natural to want to help them, to save them, to make it a little easier on them. But all the research shows that resilience just doesn't quite develop. And isn't that such an essential component to living a happy, fulfilled, healthy life?
Yes. And having functional relationships, all the things. Yes. And kids have that to a degree, significant degree, less than ever before.
When do you think kids should start learning that level of independence? I mean, obviously there's levels of that growing up, but see, a lot of times I think like for us, for example, Cade, our firstborn, had Down syndrome. So there was this need to almost overdo for him, which Pierce was like, sure, you can tie my shoes till I'm nine. You know, you're doing it for Cade. Whereas Kennedy at 15 months was like, I do it myself, you know? So part of that is personality driven.
Right.
But then is that giving them more independence based on personality, or are you trying to kind of even push the ones who don't want it?
I think you're trying to push the ones who don't want it. Because anxious kids, it's like this double-edged sword. They don't feel capable, and then often they get more attention from you when you're doing it for them. I remember a girl saying, you know, my mom is more nurturing to me when I have panic attacks than any other time.
Wow.
And so it was like they were kind of perpetuating themselves. And so it just, it's this cycle that keeps perpetuating the anxiety, and they feel like they're not having to step out and take risks, and they don't want to. They don't understand often that that is what they need, and at a much deeper level that it's what's good for them. And so, I mean, I think at every stage, really, even with toddlers, that we're letting them take risks, safe risks, obviously beyond where we feel comfortable, and we're doing a lot of communicating, you got this, you're so capable, I believe in you, over and over and over.
And it's part of the reason we don't push them is because we're anxious on their behalf.
Yes.
Like you just said, you said, let them go beyond your level of comfortability,
which
gives us a little anxiety as a parent.
Totally.
Like when Pierce first started driving,
I
couldn't fathom that.
Right. Yes.
And what's the role the non-anxious parent kind of plays in that dynamic? Because I know one parent or person in the relationship tends to have a little more of that anxiety. And I know in our relationship, that's Rebecca.
Sometimes.
and I have a little bit less. So talk about that dynamic for parents who are listening.
So what research says is that the non-anxious parent is often dismissed. And I think the anxious parent feels like they're not being vigilant enough or paying enough attention, whereas that balance is so important for the child and for the other parent, that the non-anxious parent could look at them and say, they really are okay. They really do have this.
I want to dig in a little bit to the idea of pushing your kids to independence and how this girl said, I felt the most nurture when I had panic attacks. So as a parent, there is that tension between too much or not enough, right? So I've seen kids who kind of get isolated from parents because parents are kind of letting them have all the freedom and that rope is very long. And in some ways, that's been a chasm in relationship too, because kind of parents aren't paying attention or aren't available. So that's the range, right?
From
having too much independence.
Right.
Like, how does a parent know
where you're not
involved? This is a healthy version of this, where I'm letting them make decisions for themselves and maybe feeling the consequences of those decisions, not rescuing them all the time, but also not being oblivious to what's going on or uninvolved.
I think the older I've gotten, the more simplistic I get about certain things. And when I meet with parents of teenagers, and I think especially I keep picking on type A people, and I do want to say I'm type A, so I'm picking on myself too. But
same.
But I think especially when they get to adolescence and it's so easy, you know, relationships just hard because they're not as enjoyable as they've been before. It's harder to connect with them. And so I think we can lean towards over-teaching and over-explaining to them because we're waiting for them to say, thanks, Mom, that was helpful. And you know, they just don't say that. So really what I end up, I remember standing with a parent who was leaving my office and had just been saying, I don't know what to do. I can't connect. I don't know what to do. And I literally looked her in the face and said two things. I just want you to hear me say two things before you leave, empathy and questions, where you're saying, that sounds so hard. I can't imagine what that would be like. What do you want to do about it? Where they still feel like they're having this engaged, connected time with you, but you're at the end of it saying, you got this. I believe in you. Because when we ask them questions, that's what we're really implying. You've got the answers. I'm not going to give them to you because it's not only me who can get there. You can too.
I love that. What do you want to do about
it? Yeah. What do you feel like's right? What do you think God would want you to do? Questions like that, I think, just can be groundbreaking for kids and relationally for us with them.
A lot of parents that we talk to, you know, today the question is, how much is technology contributing to this? How much is having iPhones, apps, constant access to video games, and just what the digital does to the brain, to the mind? What is your take on all that?
Well, I think it's significantly contributing to it. And part of it is that stimulation. We talked about overstimulation before. But even just, I mean, when I sit with adolescent girls, and I mean, I talked about it in the Raising Worry-Free Girls book, just technology streaks. I mean, Snapchat streaks. If we took everything out and only talked about Snapchat streaks and how they have over 100 that they have to keep up every day and send a photo or some communication. I mean, think about, we didn't have, I don't think academically, near the pressure that kids have on them today. And I did not, I mean, I would maybe talk on the phone because, you know, then we had the phone with the coiled cord that went to our other phone, the handset. I mean, maybe I talked on the phone 30 minutes to an hour a day.
Right.
But I didn't have 2 hours to be on technology. You know, yeah, I can't even imagine how they're creating time between soccer practice and eating dinner with their family and all of the homework they have piling up, all the different things they're doing, and to just return their streaks. And so I think that pressure to keep up, and I think that's part of why girls are leading the statistics, because I think they're more connected in terms of social media than boys are often after school as an adolescent.
Yeah, and I think the question then is, what do parents do about it? Because we know as parents, we're just as connected to digital, to phones, to always being on and communicating, and it's just become such a way of life that then it's hard to look at your kids and go, well, we don't want you to do it, but we're going to keep doing it. So isn't this just like a bigger conversation about our community, about how we want to live, how we need to structure our lives and create some sense of boundary around this, right? I mean, it seems impossible to do, but if we could just recreate our environment, wouldn't we probably push off some of this digital technology a bit to
absolutely
create little healthy human beings?
Yes, yes, and put good, strong limits around it. I mean, I think it's a force to be reckoned with, and it's inevitable. It's both things. I mean, it's a part of their lives. And so I think as long as we have a lot of conversation about it feels important, because I think it's not just contributing to anxiety, but depression too, and how discouraging it can feel for kids. I mean, I just talk about that with adolescent girls all the time in my office. And so conversation and then good protection in terms of that we're putting fences around it and saying, this is the time you can use it. These are the hours. No, it's not going to be in your room at bedtime. It's going to be plugged in my room, that there are just good boundaries that we have in place.
And those good boundaries, as I've heard from so many parents, are so hard to manage.
So hard.
Like Gabe and I get wiped out looking at each other trying to manage it because it would be just so simpler to go no phones forever until you're 80.
Yes.
But knowing that there are some benefits of it, we do want to know where they are when we can reach them. But still, I think there's this sense of going, yeah, we told you they couldn't go upstairs and we told you they need to be down by 9 p.m. and it's 9:30 and now we're having to go chase the phones again. What do you do?
Well, that's where I think things like Disney Circle, Teen Safe, Bark, you know, there are a lot of apps, probably those were out a month ago, there's something new today. You know, there are a lot of great things in place where we can set bedtimes, we can set limits, and it shuts them off. And so then there's not that negotiating back and forth. That's where it gets hard of, I need your phone. And when you can just turn them off, then you don't have to say, I need your phone. And so I think anything we can put in place like that is really crucial.
What are the top apps you recommend in that?
Those area. Are probably, I mean, Teen Safe and Bark are two of my favorite. Bark does a great job keeping up with social media and monitoring for words they're using, things like that. But Disney Circle I also love because it's, you can do bedtimes, you can schedule the hours they can use it, all of those things. It's helpful.
But to give some parents help, I know we have a contract with each of our kids that they signed, which we can make that available maybe in the show notes for people. But one of the principles in our contract is there's a time at the end of the evening where all the phones are in a certain place so we actually can see them. But the second thing is not allowing phones or laptops in their rooms at all. And now our kids, most of their rooms are upstairs, so it just becomes a place of isolation. I've talked to a lot of parents who they didn't put that rule in place. They've got all the other rules. But when that child or teen is alone for an extended period of time, it just seems... To me, that's a boundary we should maybe draw a hard and fast line on. Do you agree? Would you feel that strongly about
it? I do agree. I mean, I do think in all things, we want to be letting the rope out and then pulling it back in. So by senior year, I feel a little more like they should have more freedom. But yes, I mean, I don't think there are ever good things going on in terms of technology at 3 a.m. And they're often being awakened by the dings of a text or different things coming in. So yes, I think it's great to plug it in a central station where you can see it.
Now, one of the things that you've created that I've seen a few versions of this, but I love the version that you have of this emotions chart. Yeah. And part of it, because I'm, like, as we said, the non-anxious parent probably in Rebecca and I's relationship, but that doesn't mean I don't have anxiety at times. Sure. And it also means Rebecca tends to be a little better in tune with her emotions. Like I find the person who's probably more anxious is just more aware of feeling than the person who's non-anxious. Yeah. And so it's been helpful for me to look at your chart, which has these little puppy dogs on it with a different faces. And you have like 12 options on that emotions chart. And it says, name what you're feeling right now. And we do that at dinner time sometimes. We'll go around the table at the end of the day. And it's been good for me. You know, I'm like thinking, okay, what am I feeling? Am I feeling confused right now? Am I feeling angry, lonely, happy, frustrated? Because so many times now we're using the word anxiety for everything.
Right.
And we don't have language and our kids don't have language and they're just learning, hey, everybody seems to use the word anxiety to describe when they're feeling discomfort.
Yes.
How important is it to name our emotions?
Well, and again, we can talk about different ages, but I had a group of teenage girls who said to me, nobody would listen to you anymore if you said you were stressed. And so they're using this big language like anxiety to even alert other people to, hey, I'm having a hard time. And so, I mean, I think that's part of why it's important. And the one with the puppy dogs is in my book for elementary age girls called Braver, Stronger, Smarter. And the reason I called that book Braver, Stronger, Smarter is there's this profile often of little girls who are anxious, and they really are really smart. They're really conscientious. They try hard. They care deeply. Things matter to them. And it's like they just can't turn down the volume knob. And so those kids feel a lot. But again, they're the kids who don't want to say, I feel angry. I feel disappointed. My feelings were hurt by this friend. And so they stuff it all and then it becomes anxiety or worry for them. And so that child particularly, we want to teach them the words to talk about sadness, disappointment, hurt, frustration, loneliness, all of those things. Because if we don't, it does funnel over into anxiety. And then we become anxious adults because we never learned to do it.
I know you're a big believer that part of how a child works through their anxiety is they have to face it, that it's not about avoidance or removing yourself always from every tense situation. But as parents, sometimes, you know, we want to keep, as we said earlier, we want to keep them away from some of those places. How do we encourage our children to face their fears and to not just run away from them and help them at that age understand something very much more long-term in their life is going to benefit because they faced the friends that they didn't want to go to or the social environment or the taking the risk, you know, of jumping off the cliff at a lake, right? Mm-hmm. These little things that we hold back from, but what is the benefit to our children when they actually accomplish some of those things?
A lot. I mean, I think it makes them feel so much better about themselves. But part of why we want to do that is because what happens, you know, we talked about the one loop roller coaster at the fair and what we see happen as kids grow up. And if you're sitting there and you're listening, you have a child who's anxious, you totally get this, that it starts as being separated from mom or dad. So they start to have a little bit of separation anxiety and then it morphs into something else. And y'all would not believe how many 8, 9, 10-year-olds we have at Daystar who are afraid of throwing up. that they threw up once. They don't throw up very often. And so all of a sudden they can't stop thinking about throwing up. And then it morphs into something else as they get older. But the reality is it has nothing to do with what they're worried about. It's just worry. And so it's that loop. And so we want to teach them skills to handle it when it pops up and that they can fight it, both things, so that when it comes up a million times over the course of their life, because they do have this brave, conscientious, smart little personality, so it's going to come back up. It just does as you get older if you deal with it. And so they know this is not about throwing up. It's not about being away from my mom or dad. It's not about being afraid to go to the birthday party. This is just worry. And I've beat him before and done the scary thing, and I can do it again.
You have a book, Raising Worry-Free Girls,
right,
that is recently come out. And I want you to talk about that. And anyone who has daughters, you need to get this book. It's amazing. But you talk about naming the worry monster, too.
Yes.
I love it. And it just all of a sudden becomes something that you can go after versus feeling this ambiguous, powerless.
Something inside of me.
Yeah. And then with that worry, what are just practical tips? I know people are going to get your book. They're going to read it. But right now, someone who's listening that's like, I want to know, what do I do today with my daughter who's feeling this worry, whether she's in middle school, high school, elementary? What are just some of the physical things of response with breathing? What are just some first responders to that when it comes on?
So first three things I would say. The first is, and I'm sure y'all have talked about this before, but the first thing that happens when any of us get anxious is, you know, we have blood flowing all throughout our brain. When we get anxious, the blood flow shifts. It leaves our prefrontal cortex, which helps us think rationally and manage our emotions, and it goes to the amygdala, that's fight or flight. And so when I sit with parents, they will say, I can't reason with her when she gets like this. She's like a crazy person. Yes, because the reasoning part of their brain's not working.
Right.
It's gone offline. And so really, as silly as deep breathing feels and sounds sometimes, that's where it really is a game changer for kids. And so the way I have kids do it in my office is I have them draw a square on their leg, because we do breathing techniques and then we do what are called grounding techniques, which I'll come back to. But the drawing on their leg is also a grounding technique. And so with each line of the square, they breathe a different way and pause in the corner for 3 seconds. So it's just this
inhale. Exhale.
Yes, exactly. And the cool thing for kids is they can do it under their desk at school and nobody sees what they're doing. It's just a way to slow their breathing down. And it gets the blood flow away from the amygdala and back to the prefrontal cortex.
Wow.
So that's the thing I teach first. The second is we want to get them off the loop. So that's what grounding techniques, and anybody with anxiety gets this, but it's like you float out into the atmosphere. You're not even in the present moment when you get really anxious. And so it's like grabbing your feet and pulling you back to the ground. So with kids, I will have them name everything in the room they see that's the color blue, or every word they can think of that starts with the letter T, or my favorite one is 5-4-3-2-1, where they say 5 things they see, 4 things they hear, 3 things they feel, 2 things they smell, 1 thing they taste, whatever order. I get it confused every time. But basically, their senses are grounding for them. So something like that pulls them back into the moment. And then the third thing is we want to teach them to talk back to the worry monster. And so with each kid, I have them come up with a name for it. And so they have come up with all kinds of names. I have one who calls hers Bob. I have another girl who calls hers Princess Worry, because she says she's the queen and she can boss Princess Worry around. So it doesn't matter what name. I have another one that named hers Normal after a Garfield character, I think, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. But, and then the little girl's book, I have them draw pictures of it with silly faces and in goofy clothes to give it a sense of it is outside of me and I'm stronger than it is. And it's not something that's going to, I don't have to be afraid of this. And so then when your child comes to you with more than 5 questions, like you were saying before, Gabe, you can say, is that you or is that worry or is that Bob talking right now? Because I'm not going to listen to Bob. What do you want to say back to Bob? However it manifests, they've developed this voice where they can talk back to it.
Yeah, that's wonderful and very practical, I think, especially when we're thinking about younger kids. I know one of the perspectives you bring is a faith perspective to how we think about that. That's something Rebecca and I talk a lot about. It's been such an important component to us truly understanding how to overcome some of the worry that we feel, or anxiety or panic attacks, stress. I mean, it's just built in to how it informs our way of trying to see us overcome that. You have this quote, and I want you to just describe to us, you know, what this means, because it kind of flies in the face of what a lot of people would say is the antidote to anxiety. You say, courage is not the antidote to anxiety. Trust is. What does that mean?
Well, I think I even had a parent one time who said, I feel like to keep telling my daughter that she's brave is only going to feel like more pressure. And I said, you know, I get that. I mean, that makes so much sense. You're so brave. And then all of a sudden they feel like they have to rise to it. But instead, to help them understand that God made them that way already, that he put that inside of them, and they get to trust that he's got them. And it's something that he's already placed inside. So they're just tapping into it like they would anything else, like just the gifts that he's given them. So I think that's a piece of it. But also just the bigger picture of trusting that God's already gone before them, that we're just continuing to instill those kind of ideas. Because one of the things I've seen is that I don't believe in 27 years of counseling kids that there's ever been as big of a chasm between their faith and their emotions.
Wow.
And part of that is, I think it's on us, you guys, but I think we are not doing a good job of teaching kids what it looks like to live in a fallen world anymore. Mm-hmm. Wow. I think we're living in this best day ever, living my best life, all that stuff. That's just not true. I mean, I have my best day ever maybe for 5 minutes of a day. You know, sure. It's just hard. And we keep acting like everything should be so fun and amazing for them all the time. And then when kids are just discovering their feelings and thinking, my feelings don't add up to what I'm seeing on social media or I'm hearing people talk about that faith really is. I don't feel God. Kids say that all the time. I don't feel God the way I hear other people talk about feeling him. He's not making me feel confident. He's not making me feel secure all the time. And we're not doing a good job of saying, yeah, me either. You know, it's in glimpses, this side of heaven.
Yeah, and so much of our culture has focused on feelings,
yes.
Right? That they are the main guide to what's true. And we know that's not true, that truth lives outside of just our feelings. And that in some ways we have to help our feelings come into alignment with what we know to be true, even outside of how our emotions will play tricks on us. And you're doing such good work to help so many people find how to live this out. And as I see this little home of hope, mm-hmm. right, and the kids and families going in and out, I'm just blown away by the number of people you're serving, that people who haven't gone there or haven't dealt with this maybe yet in their life, or maybe they didn't know there was an option to help their children, they would just be blown away by mm-hmm. how many people are having access to this because of your good work. I do finally want to ask you a question that's important to Rebecca and I, and I think to those who are listening, that's very personal, just about your own rhythms. And how do you, who you're giving out all day long, you're sitting in sessions, counseling people through their own anxiety, worry, feelings, and to do that, you have to come at that from a place of strength. And I know there's certain days you don't, you know, you really probably don't have it, but you have to keep bringing it, right? This is your work in the world. But what are some of the rhythms for your own life, like that help you to rest, help you be restored physically, help you stay creative? Just give us any insight you have to those who are listening to go, yeah, how does she do it? What's going on behind the scenes that allows Sissy Goff to have so much to still give to others?
Frederick Buechner helps me a lot. I don't know if y'all read him, but he is my favorite. And I get a little email. That's one of the things I do is every morning before I get out of bed, I read my little daily Frederick Buechner idea. And I think just staying in scripture too and praying a lot, I think lately, even in the season of my life, and a dog. I have a dog that helps me immensely. Petting a dog, I think, makes a difference for all of us. She works with me every day. She's really cute. So those would be some of the main things. And I'm one of those people who feels extroverted and I'm highly introverted. And so I have to have a lot of time by myself where I'm just, I kind of have protected hours in the day where I'm just by myself and think. And it's not only, I wish it was all reading and praying. And a lot of times it's, here I am, a one on the Enneagram too. I have to organize. You know, I just have to do those little things that I realize more and more. This isn't just that I like control and need things to be a certain way. This really does feed me in a silly but true way. I mean, it's part of who I am.
Well, I, for one, am so grateful for your work and the reach of Daystar. And I know thousands of mamas and dads feel the same with their children. And so those of you who are listening who might not live in Nashville and have this local, she's an excellent writer. And there's so many resources available to you, whether it's the feelings chart or Name Your Worry Monster. She's just got a wealth of information. So thank you for sharing that. And thank you for breaking it down. Mm. And you're like, you know, your first three things to do. I think so many of us for so long have been overwhelmed by it and just not knowing how to navigate and just one step at a time, just walking it through and not making it feel so overwhelming. Thank you for doing that. You're just welcome. Kind of really dissecting it. And for these girls who are six, I think of Joy even. She's six. She has her own version of anxiety coming from an orphanage up until a year ago. Yes. And I see that kind of play out a little bit, but I feel so much more equipped as a mama to her, maybe than I would have felt even to Kennedy a decade prior. But I know that God redeems the time. He puts the right people in the path.
Yes, he does. He uses all those things for them and for you.
For sure. So we're grateful for you. Thank you for coming on.
I'm grateful for y'all and what y'all are doing to change the world in terms of hope. And I mean, y'all are doing so much about mental health and just life. And
well, thank you, girl.
Yeah, grateful for you both.
Great having you. Wasn't she great? She's such a well of wisdom. And the one thing I love that she talked to me about as a mama is that kids need you to listen and they need you to have empathy.
Yeah.
And part of it, I think sometimes I'm a firstborn and I didn't realize that a firstborn comes with this innate nature to want to fix. And so I think I often with our kids take it on like I'm going to quality control the situation and set everything up for success for them and try to then narrow what their freedom really looks like, which then makes them want to rebel, you know, because nobody really wants you to rescue them in your way. It's part of my lesson as a mom has been let go, let go, let go. And I find the more that I just ask questions and listen, the more empathy we can show. And one thing Sissy said that I just keep remembering is when a child poses their problem, instead of you swooping in, you can just say, so what do you want to do about that? All of a sudden, you're giving agency back to that child to go, hey, you're strong enough for this. You can face this. I'm on your team. I'm supporting you. I've got your back. But you really need to lead in what you think you need.
Yeah. And a lot of this gets back to the connect rhythm, something that you've written a lot about, one of the four rhythms that we need in our life to trade stress and anxiety. But connection is just at the core of it. Mm-hmm. We don't feel alone anymore. We have somebody who's listening. I even think of Joy, who's 6 years old. And last night, I was sitting on the couch, I had my laptop out, I was sending an email or something, and she'd come home from school, so we'd hung out a little bit, but then she was kind of sitting beside me on the couch, and I started doing this email, and she looked at the laptop and literally put her hand up to shut it. Like, she knew that this laptop was creating disconnection, and she wanted connection.
Yeah.
So we shut the laptop, we laid on the couch, we started playing, and she's so happy, but it's just funny how even at 6-year-old, she knows a little bit of English, but she hasn't quite even figured out how to communicate all that. She knew enough to say, I need connection and I need it now. And as parents responding to that, I think sends them that signal of attachment and I need you as much as you need me.
She knows that when that thing shuts, like your focus shifts, right? And wow, that's so powerful. I think one thing we're all learning as parents, those of you who are listening, when the iPhone came out in 2007, I don't know about how old your kids were at the time, but our kids were 2, 4, and 6. And that's when healthy attachment's forming. And then I was like, oh, look at this cool smartphone and Facebook. And it became a distraction when attachment's supposed to be forming and strong. And I, you know, we can't rewrite the past. I'm not like carrying a bunch of guilt around. But what I do know is I've learned from that. Like how am I re-looking at the way I'm still attaching to my teens or Joy now that she's with us? Like we can redeem the time through God. Like he can actually give us back some of those opportunities to reconnect and be more mindful of the things that are open, you know, like a laptop right in front of our kids.
Yeah. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode. I feel like sometimes these episodes are just great counseling sessions and normally they cost a lot of money, but through this podcast, they're free. So I hope you're enjoying it and you'll share it with friends, share it with other parents, this particular episode, because I think it'll help a lot of parents have some better language for what to do, how to think about this well, how to prepare themselves for these conversations with their kids at any age. And subscribe to this podcast. Leave your reviews. It continues to grow. We're so excited about the momentum this conversation's gaining. And by all means, go out and get Sissy Goff's book, Raising Worry-Free Girls. Even if you have boys, get this book. It's so good, so practical, so helpful. And until next time, we hope you have a great week.